This podcast is brought to you by Northern Motor Group.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio, your voice of football here in Australia and right around the world. I'm your host, Louise Taffer, and the Graham Arnold era begins with a win over Kuwait. All the goals and post-match interviews to come. Plus, we'll be catching up with a Matilda and W League star from Sydney FC. That at 6:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. And the countdown is well and truly on ahead of the start of the A-League season, which is just 3 days away, Josh.
Absolutely. I'm so excited. We'll have some actual games to talk about, Louise.
Finally. It's been, as we've touched on, the longest preseason in the world, I think.
We do like to draw things out here in Australia.
But we've 6 months?
The longest World Cup qualifying campaign, the longest off-season.
That we did. What was it, 22 games?
Oh, something ridiculous. I don't know how many million miles they covered via air. And plenty of the A-League teams will be covering plenty of miles as well with the distance derby between Perth Glory and Wellington Phoenix. Not far away, of course. It's exciting times with so many teams improving, so many high-profile players coming to the league. And it's going to be really, really exciting with an FFA Cup final rematch and preview, I suppose, and a Melbourne derby in the first slate of games.
Crazy. What a schedule we have ahead of us. But before we get to all of that, take me through some of the latest news headlines.
Absolutely, Louise. Making headlines in Australian football was, of course, the Socceroos game this morning with Graham Arnold getting his second tenure in charge of the national team off to a flying start. Australia won 4-0 away to Kuwait in the heat of Kuwait City with an own goal giving them the lead before Apo Gianu opened his account for the Green of Gold with a finish from close range. Tom Rogic extended the advantage in the 82nd minute, but it was the final strike, Awa Mabil's goal on debut, that made the headlines.
Days. Cruz finding Dayich. Cruz again looking for Yano. It's an own goal. Yano couldn't reach it, but it didn't matter in the end. Robbie Cruz claims an assist. And in the most fortuitous of circumstances, Australia take the lead on 12 minutes. Tend in their own half of the pitch, and this is Josh Risden with the cutback. Jackson Irvine into the box, and Yano will put it away for his first international goal. And Apostolos Yano really couldn't miss from that sort of range. Rogic onside. Little back heel, hung up for Matthew Leckie and tipped over. Like-for-like replacements, even though they've held up the wrong number on the sideline. Here's Tommy Rogic, chance for three, scores. That should do it, that should wrap it up for Australia. It's a good touch by Juric to get clear of the defender. And here's a chance for Awa Mabil, who rounds off his international debut with his first goal for his country. What a moment. A lovely moment between the two of them.
What a moment indeed. Thanks, of course, to Fox Sports and Simon Hill. Great job on the call there. For that audio, what a moment for Awa Mabil and his friend Thomas Deng. They grew up together in South Australia and they celebrated that goal together for the Socceroos after Deng won the ball that started the move and Mabil finished it off superbly. Elsewhere in Australian football news, the FFA board meeting is currently in process where expansion headlines the agenda. The A-League boss Greg O'Rourke will make a recommendation as to which expansion bids should be successful, but the decision is likely to be passed on to the new incoming administration, so a public announcement is not expected for another month. Usain Bolt could be on his way out of Australia sooner than expected, with Maltese Premier League side Valletta FC presenting him with a 2-year contract offer. And FFA have confirmed that the Central Coast Mariners will not be able to dip into the marquee fund in order to compete with that offer, so it seems Usain Bolt will probably be making his way to the former club of Michael Mifsud, who's just been cut, replacing him with Usain Bolt. Little A-League connection there. And in a boon for local football, the Victorian government has today announced $5 million in funding for the Casey Fields Regional Community Football Facilities Project. The redevelopment will include the construction of 4 new floodlit pitches, 1 turf and 3 synthetic, and a new female-friendly pavilion with change rooms, amenities and an undercover spectator area. Construction expected to be completed by early 2020.
Wow, plenty going on in Australia, Josh, but I think we'll continue on with your headline story, that being the Socceroos, of course. They secured a 4-0 win over Kuwait this morning. And as predicted, Danny Vukovic started in goal and Mark Milligan wore the captain's armband. A little earlier, though, we caught up with Fox Football's analyst Phil Moss to review the match.
Just before we go to that interview, Louise, there is some breaking news with Ray Gatt, as always, newsbreaker on Twitter. He says apparently the FFA board is split. No expansion at this stage and the decision is to be left to the new board. So apparently there's been a little bit of disharmony in the meeting. They're not sure which expansion bids they are, you know, have a consensus on. So could be a difficult process for the new incoming board with less decision-making time to decide on the two bids. Now, without further ado, Louise, we will go to that interview with former Sydney FC assistant coach, former Central Coast Mariners boss, and a long-time a co-worker of Graham Arnold's, Phil Moss, telling us about the Socceroos game this morning and the start of a new era for the national team. Thanks for joining us, Phil. First of all, what did you make of the performance this morning?
Yeah, look, I thought it was good. It was, you know, I didn't think we had a bad player, difficult conditions. There was a gulf in class, I thought, between the Socceroos and Kuwait. But it gave Graham Arnold a real opportunity to put into practice, I guess, what he's worked on in the last two camps where he opted not to have games. And it was kind of like a pre-season set-up with clubs in Europe where you train for a while and then your first game is against an opposition where you think you can put everything into practice, gain some confidence, score some goals. And that's with all due respect to Kuwait. But I thought it was a good, solid first outing under Graham Arnold.
And Phil, obviously there have been quite a number of new faces coming into the fold, as well as returning players. Who really stood out for you?
Yeah, look, there was a few. I mean, you know, I thought if I go back to front, I think the subs that came on all had a real impact. Daniel Arzani, Juric, I thought was good. Mabil, of course, scored his goal. Thomas Deng, and wasn't that a good little subplot to the game as well, seeing Mabil and Deng celebrating together with the rich history that they bring to the Socceroos, and that's a wonderful story on its own. But, so I thought they all added really good impact off the bench, and I think Tommy Rogic looked a lot more lively with two holders behind him, and the way Graham Arnold likes to play, you know, he works very, very hard on getting numbers in the box when the ball's in wide areas, and I thought there were some really true hallmarks of the way he coaches tactically in the performance this morning.
You mentioned Thomas Deng and Awa Mabil there, Phil. You would have coached against them or been assistant manager against them in the A-League, and obviously it's a fantastic story for them coming through, being former South Sudanese refugees and making Australia their new home. When you coached against them in the A-League, did you, you know, ever expect that they'd get to this level?
Look, I mean, you know, this is just a start for them at international level, and, you know, I know Graham Arnold's always given young players an opportunity if he thinks they're good enough. And, you know, there was nothing this morning to suggest that they won't go on and forge fantastic international careers for themselves. But, yeah, look, coaching against them, they were always, Mabil was always very tricky to defend against because he played with a really free spirit. You know, he was very creative, quick, particularly over the first 5 or 10 metres. And, you know, had an eye for goal. So that's always tough when you play against those players. And Thomas Deng, always strong, solid, read the game well. So, you know, I'm not surprised to see them where they are. But as I think Mark Milligan said, presenting them with the jersey, the hard work starts now. So I'm sure they would have taken that on board.
And Phil, we are heading into a new World Cup cycle. What do you think should be the main goals?
Scoring goals. I think you hit the nail on the head, Louise. You know, that's something that we've struggled to do, and Graham Arnold's made no secret of the fact that he believes that it was too reliant on one player to score goals for the Socceroos in the past. And as I said, he spends a lot of time, you know, on patterns of play and rotations and getting the ball into dangerous areas. And when the ball is there, it's very automated for other players to know where they have to be in the box and when they need to arrive there. So once you get the right players in the right positions in the attacking third, then you're going to create a lot of opportunities, provided you've got the quality in those areas, and that's what he's working towards now.
And you know Arnie as well as anyone, and you've worked with him for quite some time. What would have been the first changes he made when he came into his new role as Socceroos boss, either behind the scenes or in training?
Yeah, look, he's very big on making sure everyone enjoys themselves and makes it an enjoyable environment and a very, very strong culture around the team mentality before any individual and a family environment, I guess. And they would have been the main things. And I think that's why he really wanted those two camps without a game before this Kuwait game, so he could really bed down some of those principles and the cultural aspect that he likes to introduce. And you can see the players, they're playing with a smile on their face already. You can see from the training vision that we've seen through the two camps that there's a lot of laughter. But when it's time to knuckle down and work hard, they're doing that. And that's, as I said before, they're all the hallmarks of Graham Arnold and how he manages the team environment.
And Bert van Marwijk is now in the rearview mirror, and so is Ange Postecoglou. How does Arnie's style differ from Ange's and Bert van Marwijk's?
Yeah, well, I think those two in particular were at real different ends of the spectrum. You know, Ange was all about an attacking philosophy and probably left himself a bit wider open defensively, whereas Bert van Marwijk was the opposite. He was rock solid on defence and making sure that the Socceroos were hard to beat. And I think, you know, I honestly believe, and I don't think either of those styles are wrong, but I think Graham Arnold has a very balanced approach with and without the ball. He knows that you can't always have a great night on the ball. So if that's the case, then you need a very solid defensive structure to fall back on. But he also spends a lot of time coaching in transition, and they are key moments in the modern game, as we all know. So where are you when we either lose the ball or we win the ball? And what's your job? And how can we penetrate the opposition, or how can we break the play up to win the ball back? So, you know, he spends a lot of time in the video room, a lot of time on the training pitch, coaching to those things, and he's been very successful doing it.
Is that the main focus for Arnie tactically then, those transition moments? Because, you know, I noticed a lot of the Socceroos' goals this morning came from the ball being won sort of in the middle of the midfield and then the counter-attack being sprung very quickly. Are those moments, you know, very choreographed in training?
Yeah, they are. They certainly are. Everything is coached to by Graham Arnold, and he doesn't leave any stone unturned. I think it's pretty it's down in Australian football folklore now what his attention to detail is, and he's always got a plan A, B, and C for every situation, and that's why he's been so successful in the A-League with teams from the Central Coast Mariners to Sydney FC, and they're at different ends of the spectrum. So they are a key part of the game, but he coaches in a very balanced manner for all main moments of the game, which is with and without the ball and transition both ways.
And behind the scenes, we know he can be, you know, frosty with the media at times, but is he a different character, you know, behind the scenes in training camps and when he's with the players behind closed doors?
I don't know where this grumpy thing comes from with Graham Arnold, because he's one of the best blokes you'll ever meet. And I think anyone who's ever, you know, worked for him or under him, and I certainly can speak for friends as well. He's a very affable character. What you see is what you get. And he's really worked hard for this opportunity, and he's the first to admit that he wasn't ready, you know, when he got his first opportunity with the national team. But he really looks well prepared now to take this with both hands.
And Phil, only two more games left before the Asian Cup. Is that enough preparation time? And do you think we can see more rotation for the games against Lebanon and Korea?
Yeah, it's a good question, Louise. It is a short preparation. There's no doubt about that. And there was talk about Bert van Marwijk and his short preparation going into the World Cup. It's very similar. And will three games be enough? Time will tell. But certainly, I think he's made a very, very big impact already. And I think the difference between a Bert van Marwijk coming in with a short preparation and Graham Arnold is Arnie totally understands the Australian culture and he's worked with a lot of those players and developed a lot of those players in the past. So I think the transition will be much quicker. And I think one of his concerns going into the Socceroos setup was that he was the third coach in a very, very short space of time. But the players adapted very well, and they've taken to the way he wants to be and play. And you could see that this morning. It was very, very clear. And for him to have an impact like that so quickly, I think augurs very well for the Asian Cup.
And Phil, just touching on one player in particular, Daniel Arzani isn't playing first team football at the moment at Celtic. Fresh reports have come out yesterday saying he has a get out clause where if he's not played for the Hoops by December, he can return to Manchester City. Just your thoughts on the situation.
Yeah, look, I hope that's the case because I was adamant from day one that it was a wrong move for him without knowing the ins and outs behind the scenes of the deal. But I just thought Celtic and Scottish football, with all due respect to Scottish football, I just thought it was the wrong fit for Daniel Arzani. He wasn't a 90-minute player when he left the A-League. He only broke into the Melbourne City lineup just after Christmas, so he didn't even play a full half a season. And he's gone somewhere like Scotland and Celtic and not getting a run. So I always thought the best place for him would be a Holland or a Scandinavia. If you think back to Trent Sainsbury when he left us at the Central Coast Mariners, he went to Pex Zwolle in Holland and he played regularly almost from the start, although he had a bit of an injury setback. But his career's blossomed because he was playing regular football. So I think Daniel Arzani needs to get out of there, and I think he needs to go somewhere where he's going to play regularly in the first team.
I couldn't disagree with you there, Phil. And just one last one. It's been 10 years since Graham Arnold first coached this Socceroos side, and you've had the pleasure and the privilege of seeing him develop as a coach since then in multiple roles. What's really changed for Graham Arnold? How has he grown and developed as a coach, you know, since he first coached the Socceroos on an interim basis?
We probably haven't got enough time to go into all of it, but look,
yeah, sum it up in 1 minute, Phil.
I think his man management style and you know how selfless he is. He'll do anything for his staff and his players, including take the heat off them in the media if it means him copping some a barrage of criticism. But you know, just the way he gets in players' heads and flushes them clean, I guess. So when they cross the white line on game day, they've got nothing else to think about but their performance, and they already know what they have to go and do. He's just a very thorough coach. He's spent a lot of time on upskilling in his leadership skills and learning from other coaches, from business leaders. And he takes his job very, very seriously. So as I said before, you couldn't wish anything but success for Arnie now with the national team, because he's worked so hard to earn the right to coach his country.
Well, Phil, we really do appreciate your time. It's a new era for a Socceroos, and we do appreciate your insights as well. We look forward to speaking to you again down the line.
Absolute pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, and that's Fox Football's analyst Phil Moss, who we caught up with a little earlier to review the Socceroos' win over Kuwait. And he made some good points, saying he actually had high praise for a lot of the substitutes who came off the bench and made some impact. He also said that Graham Arnold spends quite a lot of time on patterns of play and reviewing transition moments. And he added that Daniel Arzani needs to get out of Celtic and go elsewhere, maybe Holland, to get some first-team football.
I think he's spot on there. A more technical league would suit Daniel Arzani better, somewhere where it's a little less, I mean, it's stereotypes, of course, but it is a little less kick and rush. I mean, Celtic don't play kick and rush football. They try and keep the ball, but other teams play it against them, and you're expected to track up and back as a winger. And I just think for Arzani, it's the wrong environment. You need to get somewhere where he's going to get on the ball and he's going to get first-team opportunities, because what's the difference between playing reserve team football in Scotland and playing in the A-League? It's probably a lower level.
Well, Phil did make reference to Pek Zwolle in the Netherlands. Of course, we know that former Melbourne City boss John Van Skip is over there. Mm. He's also with Michael Valkanis. And we've recently seen two players from Melbourne City transition over there on loan, Denny Jonro and goalkeeper Dean Bouzanis. So maybe that is the place for Daniel to go and get regular game time.
It could be. I think it'll be another loan move, because I don't believe City is going to let him go permanently at this point, you know, without decent return on their investment in him, both in terms of, you know, coaching resources back at Melbourne City and also the transfer fee they would have paid. I suppose they're transferring with themselves, so it's a bit different. But I think Arzani needs to move to a different level and a different league to get game time, and because he needs to develop his aerobic fitness. And if he's not going to do that playing reserves.
That's it. And Josh, just your thoughts on the absence of Mile Jedinak and Tim Cahill last night.
I think it's probably the right time for both of them to move on. I think Millet, if he really wanted to, he could have played through to the Asian Cup, but you know, it's sort of a selfless decision from him to say, I'm not here long term. I need to let the players behind me and the younger players get more opportunities in those midfield positions. And especially you look at someone like Mas Luongo, who didn't get 1 minute of game time at the World Cup when his club performances really, you know, deserved more. So I think it's probably the right time for both of them to step away. Obviously, Timmy's got his special farewell game against Lebanon, where he's likely to get a few minutes off the bench. And it means the team is a lot more pacey and dynamic. I mean, Cahill, you know what he's going to give you. He's going to be a target in the box. He's going to score goals, but he's not necessarily going to be involved in that much of the play. And having a different sort of player like Gianni, who can include other players and link up with them, maybe drop a little bit deeper off the front line. And there's been talk that Arnie wants to try Matt Leckie as a striker, which could be really interesting, get some real pace in behind to really stretch defences. I think it bodes well for the national team to move on from these experienced figures and find something new. And then again, it was Q8. I mean, they were pretty at sea defensively. They had some nice technical players going forward, but they didn't make too many inroads. So it's hard to read in from one match, but some bright signs for the Socceroos for sure.
Yeah, and I feel like Tom Rogic really stepped up last night and we saw what he is really capable of.
Absolutely. It really bodes well that Arnie was able to get a lot out of Tom Rogic. Obviously, he's going to struggle a little bit more against sturdier defences, but he was freed from most of his defensive responsibilities and drifted around more to find space with those two holding midfielders in behind him doing most of the defensive work. And I think that suits Rogic. If you ask him to, you know, to do too much running and too much defensive work, you're not going to get the best out of him when he does get on the ball, because he's another one like Arzani who struggles with the physical side of the game, but technically is absolutely outstanding. So his performance last night, getting balls in behind the opposition fullback and playing in the wingers and then capping it off with that goal, it was a bit of a miss hit, but he got it in the bottom corner. I think that's fantastic from Rogic, because we need him to really lead this new team.
Well, Josh, we are going to leave the Socceroos talk there for the time being. We'll come back to that in the next hour, but we're going to take a short break, and coming up is Sydney FC's Chloe Legazzo.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR and you're with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And remember, you can get involved at any time by giving us a call on 03 9944 9999, or you can tweet to us at FNR_radio. Now, Josh, at the weekend, Usain Bolt scored 2 goals. And off the back of his performance, we've heard that now an overseas club in Malta, on his tail, basically, and offering him a contract. The Central Coast chief executive issued a statement saying that Usain Bolt will continue his indefinite training period with the Central Coast Mariners until any further notice. Football agent Tony Rallis has said there is a club in Europe that is offered, as we know, Bolt a 2-year deal. They have been taken over by new owners who have aspirations of UEFA Champions League football. Now, where does this leave the Mariners?
I think it actually might be best for all parties. I mean, maybe the Mariners won't think this way, but I don't think Usain Bolt is good enough to play in the A-League, regardless of his 2 goals against a side that had never played together, made up of NPL players out of season in a trial game. I don't think he's good enough. He's going to get eaten alive by defenders at that level. Like, think of Usain Bolt up against Bart Schoekenveld. He won't get a sniff. And even in that game where his 2 goals drew so much attention, he lost the ball I don't know how many times. His touch was terrible. I think he completed 2 or 3 passes for the entire game. He had that one isolated moment where he scored a nice finish off a really nice pass from Ross McCormack. And then it was an open goal tap-in from about a metre away for the second one. So I don't think that really tells you anything about, you know, Usain Bolt's football prowess, but it did go viral, and apparently it's good enough for Valletta FC to offer him a 2-year deal and hope that he will spearhead their charge to the Champions League, according to ESPN.
And based on Bolt's first initial performance that we saw a month ago,
yes,
did you think that there was improvement?
Oh, absolutely, especially just cardio-wise. I mean, what we were talking about with Dr. Craig Duncan on Friday, they've obviously done a lot of work with him and he's able to get through a lot more running. But in terms of his actual football skill, I'm not sure there is a huge amount of improvement, and he doesn't have the football technique and the changing of directions and stuff that you really need to succeed at a high level, at a professional level. So I just think the A-League is too good for him, and he will disappoint if he gets the opportunity in the A-League, and the kind of money that Central Coast were talking about spending on him is just ridiculous, regardless of the amount of sponsorship he would have brought in. So they've got the publicity hit. They've got the sugar rush of however many million people watching videos on their Twitter page. But you look at, you know, maybe they've got more followers than a lot of A-League clubs now, but they don't have more membership sales. So is this a long-term thing that's going to, you know, bring people through the gates and be successful? I don't think it is. I think it's a short-term publicity hit, which is good for them, but you know, how much good does it do when you're talking about offering him $900,000 a year?
Well, that's it. And I mean, David Gallop actually commented on the whole situation, and he said, should the Mariners, well, he initially said that they're not going to dip into the marquee fund, but should the Mariners sign Bolt, FFA will consider ways to contribute off-field cash in the form of marketing arrangements with Bolt.
Well, that's it. I mean, I think the best possible course of events would be for him to secure a contract elsewhere, and then perhaps he can act as a club ambassador or something of that capacity going forward. Because just as a player, I just don't think he's up to the level, and it's a bit of an insult to not only the young players coming through at NPL and A-League youth level, they're not getting a chance ahead of him, but also, you know, it's counterproductive in terms of the foreign players they could sign with that money who would actually add real on-field value to the team. And, you know, it's a little bit weird that we're even discussing this, Louise. It still feels quite surreal. But we are joined now by a W-League special guest.
We are. It is Sydney FC's midfielder, Chloe Legazzo. Chloe, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
A brand new season is just around the corner. How have preparations been, and do you feel like you're in a good place at the moment?
They're good. I've been watching the girls train since coming back from the national team. Unfortunately, I haven't really been around the team as much in regards to pre-season, but the vibe feels good, and this season's going to be one of the best, I think.
And Chloe, it's Josh here. You went down in the grand final to City last season. Has the squad put that behind them and just looking ahead, or is there lessons that you've learned from that game?
Well, there's definitely lessons that we've learned from last year, not just from the grand final, but from the whole entire season. We had a pretty young team last year, and we still do this year. But hopefully those younger girls can step up in the times that we need them. Not being rookies anymore, so it'll be good for us this year. First game against Wanderers, and that'll be, I guess, one of the hardest games in the whole entire season after losing so many of our players to that team.
Well, that's it. I mean, your cross-city rivals have poached a few from the team. However, it has been announced that a trio of Americans have come into the fold, as has Alana Kennedy.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. Our Americans get here tomorrow, and Alana will be back maybe a couple of games into the season due to having surgery on her feet. But once that all happens, you know, our team's going to be very, very strong, and I really look forward to joining the team and myself.
And Lisa Devana is back on board as well. How much of a boost is having her back? You know, she had a fantastic season last time out, and that dramatic goal in the semi-final, of course, made such headlines. So are you really excited to be playing alongside her again this campaign?
Yeah, obviously Lisa and I have a personal relationship off the field, being my roommate in the national team, but having a person of her caliber playing in our team and having the amount of experience that she has is something that brings great value to Sydney FC, and I really look forward to playing domestically with her again.
And Chloe, have you noticed how much leadership she provides, especially with the younger players?
Yeah, she takes a role. Really, she says she doesn't, but she thoroughly enjoys taking a leadership approach to the younger ones and teaching them and taking them underneath her wing.
And she's like such a machine at the moment. There's no slowing down for her.
No, hopefully not. Hopefully she's in tip-top shape for the World Cup coming up. So, like I said before, I guess this W League season is going to be the most important one for not just us Sydney players, but for every national team player spread throughout the W League.
Absolutely, Chloe. And who are some of the younger players in the Sydney FC W League squad that we should look out for this season?
Top one, I think, is Princess Ibini. She's been in some pretty good form in the lead up to the W League season. Came away with us for the national team, and I think she's on fire right now, and hopefully she'll do well for us up front, score some goals like she did last year. Then Taylor Ray in the midfield. She's a young one that's coming through with the young Matilda. She has her head screwed on properly, and she's a really good kid. And then probably in the back line, Ange, I can't say her last name.
Pristodoulou?
Yes, she's another good one. So she's a little prodigy as a centre-back, and hopefully she does well this year as well and steps up.
And Chloe, what are the expectations for the team this season?
We haven't really sat down and talked about our expectations and our values in regards to that. And I don't really want to set too much pressure, I guess, on the team. From our start last year, I don't think we can get any worse. We lost our first three games. So this year, I think we're definitely in a better space mentally and physically. So I'm really looking forward to the first game.
Well, that's it. I mean, you touched on the start of the W League season in 2017-18. It wasn't the best. You were almost rock bottom for a number of weeks, but then you really turned it around, and it was this beautiful show of character that we saw.
Yeah, well, it was nice for us too. We made a few changes. We had some key international players come in. Aubrey, our goalkeeper, has stayed around since last year, and I think they were the little turning points. Like I said, our team was pretty young last year. It was just those key factors that brought the team together, I believe. And yes, it was great character for us to be able to get from where we were to the grand final, and that's football sometimes, I guess.
And Chloe, there's been a lot of changes to the W League this season. We even have a standalone Thursday night game. Your thoughts on this?
Standalone Thursday night game. I'm looking forward to it. I think that the W League has taken so many strides forward. We are now having every single game streamed live, which I think is important for us, for our exposure and people that want to follow us throughout the W League in the lead up to the World Cup and obviously internationally. Majority of the girls play overseas, and I think it's important for overseas players or fans to be able to watch us and engage in that as well, building our profile and our character.
And Chloe, have you noticed an increase in interest in the W League after, you know, the exploits of the Matildas that you've, of course, been such a part of and the growth of women's football in Australia?
I definitely agree. I think that internationally, players have always wanted to come to Australia and play in our league. I truly believe if our league was a little bit bigger, that it would be competing with one of the best leagues in the world. It already is. It's just a little bit too short. But yeah, I think the quality that we have and the fact that we have so many of our national team players, almost all of our national team players, stay home and play in our domestic league is fantastic.
And Chloe, you were recently over in Europe with the Matildas. How valuable was it to compete against the likes of France and England, two opponents who we don't normally get to face?
I think it was very, very important for me. I've never played them before, so to be able to be exposed to the top two or three teams in the world was great for me. And I don't think the national team has ever really played, or I've played the top five teams in the last year, and I don't think that's ever really happened for us. So our international exposure is great. You know, it wasn't the results that we wanted, and I guess in the public eye, it was kind of a loss. But for us, I guess it was the best thing that could have happened. We were exposed in certain parts that we haven't been exposed in with the national team, and leading up to the World Cup, I think that's very important for us to be able to, you know, dot every I's and cross every T's in regards to figuring out how to stop teams doing or exposing us the way that we were exposed. It was good for some of the younger players to get some game time And obviously, we can never say no to some international games.
Well, it's obviously the definition of an important test for the team to be able to pinpoint, you know, whatever weaknesses there are and correct them. How do you feel the World Cup preparations are going, and what still needs to happen before next year's tournament?
It's nice to know that the World Cup preparations have started and they're fully underway. In that, it's hard for us as well because we are so ready for the W League season that we kind of had to put that on hold, and we do have international games coming up in the W League season, and we're not really used to that as well either, having like an international break, you could say. But I'm looking forward to when the W League season's over, really knuckling down, because this is my first World Cup. I'm really getting prepared for it.
And that's the beauty of the W League, don't you think, having a lot of the Matildas playing in the league, and with the boost of all the internationals coming into the competition, it certainly gives you good preparation in lead-up to the FIFA Women's World Cup.
Yeah, it sure does. Reiterating what we have been saying, I definitely think it's important. It is going to be one of the best W League seasons for people getting ready and getting fit and really competing against the players that are trying to fight for a spot for the national team.
Well, Chloe, we certainly wish you all the very best in the upcoming W League season, and look forward to getting you back on the show sometime soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Sydney FC's midfielder Chloe Legazzo joining us there, Josh. And it's great to hear how, you know, there's some good things going on at Sydney FC, despite the fact that they've lost a number of players to their cross-city rivals.
Well, yes, it's certainly adds some spice to the Sydney Derby in the W League this season. And it's going to be interesting. They have recruited well to replace those players with the trio of Americans coming in. And Alana Kennedy as well, who's a player I rate so highly. I mean, she's coming off surgery, so it's not going to be easy for her. Might miss the first couple of games of the season, but she just distributes the ball so well. And, you know, she's one of those players who can play multiple positions and contribute in multiple ways, both defensively and going forward. She can hit a free kick as well, as we saw during the tournament over in the US. So I'm looking forward to seeing her in the W League playing for Sydney.
And even score some goals.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, she's got a killer shot on her. So if she advances with the ball out of defence and has space, I don't see why she shouldn't have a crack. And also offset pieces as well. She's a danger.
That's it. And speaking of danger, Lisa Devanna, great that they could retain her.
Yeah, absolutely. I wondered, you know, how long she's going to go at a professional level. I mean, she's obviously doing great things for South Melbourne in the Victorian side of things. But she's just such an important leader. She seems like a no-nonsense kind of personality who holds everyone to account. She'll let people know if they're not pulling their weight, if they're not, you know, doing the right thing, making the right run or the right pass. But, you know, she's so respected because of all of her achievements. She, you know, she's not going to put anybody offside by doing that. And Chloe obviously has a really close bond with her. She said they were roommates and they go overseas. So getting to get to play together at club level will be fantastic for those two.
It'll be interesting to see how Sydney FC go this season, given, you know, what they achieved last season. They didn't have a good run to start with, but then they turned it all around, and we saw this real show of character, as I touched on. And it was just so unfortunate that in the final series they lost Caitlin Ford due to injury. And I think that almost, you know, affected how they went in the grand final. They were a little bit, you know, they didn't have a full squad like Melbourne City.
And Melbourne City have such a full squad. I mean, it's just packed with talented players who perform at the highest level and can be relied upon in big games. And they're so experienced in big games, whereas Sydney haven't, you know, made it to those kinds of games in recent seasons. So it reminded me a little bit of Adelaide United under Guillaume Moore when they were bottom of the league at Christmas and turned it around. And it didn't have the fairy tale finish, but I think, you know, they've proven how good they can be on their day. And you know, that's all the confidence they should need going into this new season. That they could start the season the way, you know, they finished it in the second half of the W League season last time out.
Yeah, that's it. And it's even like Melbourne Victory last season. We heard Kevin Muscat was like a broken record every week, saying he wasn't really, you know, pleased with how things are going, but then at the same time, the results weren't showing it. And then look what happened with them. So
yeah.
I think with the W League last season, it was just so competitive that bottom placed Adelaide United was beating, you know, a club mid-range.
Yeah, and it is so unpredictable. I mean, much like the A-League, but probably even more so because it's a shorter season and because the teams are even a little bit closer together. There's not that stratification with, you know, the likes of Central Coast and Wellington struggling to bring in big players. The team I thought was hard done by, especially in the semi-final, was Brisbane Roar, because they played some outstanding stuff last season. Just as a team, it was almost, you know, reincarnation of Ange's Roar-Salona years. And they were robbed, I thought, of a penalty in the semi-final, I believe, against Melbourne City. Mm-hmm. I thought it was a clear penalty and that could have changed the outcome of the game. But, you know, they can't use that as an excuse, I suppose. They were top of the league at the end of the season. They couldn't make it count in the finals campaign, so unfortunate for Brisbane, but they've got something to prove this season.
Yeah, definitely. And they actually had the best defensive record in 2017-18. They only conceded 12 goals. So they looked really good from that point of view. And I think that, and I'd like to see them go one better this season.
Yeah, I think, you know, they deserve success based on the, you know, the manner in which they've played their football. And they've got Japanese import Yuki Nagasato, who I'm excited to see in action, as well as one of my favourite female footballers, Katrina Gorry, who's just such a creative force every time she steps on the pitch. I think she's an underrated player, and whenever she plays for the Matildas, it seems to improve their play. She's just someone, you know, she's almost a Luka Modric type. He's able to both control the game and dictate those decisive moments, those decisive passes and through balls that end up leading to goals. I think she's invaluable and, you know, when she's fit, unbelievable.
Well, the W League season kicks off next week. And in the A League, we have the Melbourne Derby to kickstart the campaign. Well, in the W League, we have the Sydney Derby on a Thursday night, followed by Brisbane Roar, Perth Glory. Canberra United are hosting Melbourne City. Melbourne Victory are coming up against Adelaide United. Melbourne, well, that's it. Only a couple of teams, not as many as the A-League. Josh, we are going to leave it there and take a few minutes in a short break, and we'll be back.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Josh, it's time to talk about the mainstream media, because something has come up where it has just left my jaw wide open. One sports reporter on Channel 7, who's been around for many years, said that the Central Coast Mariners will get a large cut from the Usain Bolt deal should he go to Europe. This is absolutely incorrect.
That's absolute nonsense. He's on trial. He hasn't signed a contract with them. You don't get a transfer fee. I mean, in the A-League, you often don't get transfer fees anyway, but even if they are under contract. But when it's a foreign club bidding, it doesn't matter because he hasn't signed any deal. I mean, unless there's some secret commercial arrangement that only this Channel 7 sports reporter is privy to, that is complete nonsense. And Louise, this happens so often that, you know, the mainstream media, sports reporters and so forth, the news channels, just make completely incorrect statements about, you know, about Australian football and the round ball game. I mean, I was watching, I think it was ABC News the other night, and they were talking about the A-League launch, and they said, you know, the governing bodies are embroiled in this, you know, battle over expansion, and the A-League clubs are fighting expansion. That's completely incorrect. I mean, most A-League clubs actually want expansion. There are certain teams who would prefer certain bids didn't make it into the league so that they wouldn't, you know, get into their cut into their catchment area. But it's completely false to suggest the A-League clubs are against the idea of expanding the league and making it, you know, more vibrant and getting more of variety in terms of the way it's played and getting more fans on board.
Well, there was something else that came out, again, from Channel 7, and it was on the back of one of their newspapers saying dementia, Alzheimer's, could heading a soccer ball damage the brain? A breakthrough study.
Okay, this is, I mean, there is some evidence to suggest that maybe, you know, young footballers potentially shouldn't be heading the ball maybe before their brains are fully developed and so forth. But,
well, I mean, Tim Cahill's okay.
Yeah, well, that's true, but, you know, it's usually onset later in life, and there has been some research that's come out of the UK. This is not a breakthrough study. This is several years ago that this came out, and they're just re-reporting it. And the timing, I mean, is just so cynical. On the eve of the A-League season, it's just like, come on.
I mean, this conversation is still very much an open question. But then again, you look at other sports with full body contact. You look at the NFL, and I don't imagine rugby or AFL would be any different. The constant shock.
I think
shock,
rugby would be worse.
I would imagine so. The constant shock on your body can lead to the onset of CTE and dementia, and there's all sorts of scary studies coming out about that. So it's not just about heading footballs. I mean, that's way down the list when it comes to risk of brain injury.
I agree with you there, but it's just amazing how some of the mainstream media outlets can just really portray football in such a negative light.
I mean, there was a documentary that came out of the UK. I think it was Alan Shearer presenting it on whether heading footballs is dangerous. And it's not a settled question whatsoever. And there are some experts who've come out and said, you know, children under the age of 14 should not be heading balls in training. And personally, I wouldn't have a huge problem with that because, you know, you want to encourage young players to play football on the ground and develop their technical skills. And heading the ball or something is a technique that can be honed, you know, later and but, you know, at the professional level, it's I don't think that's going to change anytime soon. We're not going to be playing futsal in the A-League.
No, I agree with that. Well, moving on, touching back to the Socceroos, did you know that there are 400 football teams in Kenya's Kukama refugee camp, and many of them are actually wearing recycled Australian kits thanks to the Socceroos' new hero?
Oh, that's absolutely fantastic to hear, isn't it?
But 400 football teams, that's massive.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you look at some of the refugee communities and new arrivals to Australia, and a way to help them integrate into Australian society and also help them link up with other people from similar backgrounds is through football. I mean, the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre here in Melbourne has a football team, and there's plenty of other examples. I mean, later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Asma Halal from Football United about the work that she does with refugees through football, and it's just such a powerful uniting force. And you know, that's over in Kenya. They're not even in Australia yet, but they're looking up to their new heroes, Awa Mabil and Thomas Deng.
Yeah, that's it. And what a beautiful story it is to see both of them debut only minutes apart and share such a nice journey from start to, not finish yet, but halfway.
Yeah, absolutely. They actually grew up a street away from each other in South Australia. So they played football together growing up in the park, you know, 9-10 years ago. And now they've both made their Socceroos debuts together just a few minutes apart, with Deng winning the ball, dishing off to Juric, and then he put Mabil through for his debut goal. And that photo of them both celebrating together was just the best thing to come out of this morning's game, in my opinion.
I agree with you. And I think that we should touch back on some of the Socceroos highlights.
Well, new beginnings. The second Graham Arnold era starts, and strangely, it is against the same opening opposition as his first 12 years ago. That is why this is such a good opponent for the Socceroos as they start preparations for their Asian Cup defence. The answer is particularly a good delivery from Rogic. Might get a second go at it. In fact, he's going to have a pop at goal, and it's on target, but straight into the breadbasket of Hamid Alcala. Here's Massimo Luongo, who can probably count himself extremely unfortunate to not play a single minute of two World Cup campaigns. Cruz finding Bajic. Cruz again, looking for Yano. It's an own goal. Yano couldn't reach it, but it didn't matter in the end. Robbie Cruz claims an assist. And in the most fortuitous of circumstances, Australia take the lead on 12 minutes. Now we're ready for Rogic's corner. Angle back, and Aziz Bajic with a complete air swing at the ball. Might get another chance here. Still Aziz Bajic, and the goalkeeper, Alcala, out to smother. Australia will have another corner.
Well, that ball fell back for Aziz Bajic. There was a feeling that he might try and shoot with his right foot.
It's a nice touch from Fahad Alanesi in Kuwait, looking to build something here. Al Massawi in towards the near post, where Trent Sainsbury had that particular area well guarded. Penned in their own half of the pitch, and this is Josh Risden with the cutback. Jackson Irvine into the box, and Yanu will put it away for his first international goal. And Apostolos Yanu really couldn't miss from that sort of range. Rogic onside, little back heel, hung up for Matthew Leckie, and tipped over
and a quick recalibration for the goalkeeper. He hung nicely, didn't he?
Not the right option, really, but Abdullahi will tee it up for Al-Azmi. Oh, that's a good effort. And a good save by Vukovic. His first real work tonight, and it's the substitute, Michel Al-Azmi.
In response, though, to Danny Vukovic. Good work.
Blocked challenge by Luongo. This is Josh Risden. Now, he's looking for his first international goal, similar to Apostolos Yano, and might have had it, but for a good stop down to his left by Hamid Al-Khalif.
Quantity of young.
Here's Azani making his way through around the goalkeeper. His touch just took him too wide for the angle to shoot, and then Juric in the air couldn't generate the power. But another little glimpse of the talents of Daniel Azani. Just darted his way into the penalty area. It was great to watch.
I think the host director quite fancies what Daniel Arzani's done, this little highlights package already, featuring Arzani.
Like-for-like replacements, even though they've held up the wrong number on the sideline. Here's Tommy Rogic, chance for three, he scores. That should do it, that should wrap it up for Australia. And Tommy Rogic gets on the score sheet. That's not a bad effort at all by Fahad Al-Ansari. And that's the closest they've come to a goal all night. And it rebounds off the frame. That's a good touch by Juric to get clear of the defender. And here's a chance for Awa Mabil, who rounds off his international debut with his first goal for his country. What a moment. A lovely moment between the two of them. And the referee brings proceedings to a close. In the end, it was pretty comfortable for Australia.
With thanks to Fox Sports, the Socceroos defeated Kuwait this morning 4-0, thanks to one own goal, and the rest were scored by the boys. One of the great narratives from the match was Awa Mabil's debut and the fact that he scored on debut. Mm.
Thank you very much. It's a really amazing day. You know, it hasn't all sunk in yet, but I feel like I'm dreaming. So to score my debut and to actually make my debut is something special for me and special for my family. The goal is for my mother and my siblings, because they helped me realize, they helped me along the tough times to get to where I am today. And this debut and this goal is for them. Yeah, it's amazing. It's something that we'll tell our grandkids, or maybe our kids. We'll brag about it, that we grew up together, and also that we managed to play for Australia together. So on the same night, it's amazing, and something that will live long in our memories, and especially for the young Sudanese kids in Australia. This is a pathway that we're setting for them, and now they have to realize that their dreams can become true. And it's not just Sudanese now, it's also the young Australian kids, that no matter the obstacles in the way, if you follow your dreams and work hard and listen, you will realise your dreams before you know it.
Inspiring words there from Awa Mabil. And now let's hear from his good childhood friend, Thomas Ding, about his debut for the national team.
Oh, it's a massive achievement. It's surreal, you know, when you think about it. It's been a long journey to get here. And once you're finally here, it's something real special, and something that you can always look back on and, you know, and remember. I actually haven't looked on my phone yet, so I think it's going to be crazy.
You spent just over 15 minutes on the pitch tonight. What did you make of your first appearance in the green and gold?
Well, the past week's been a very good test, especially coming in for my first camp, trying to learn from the coaching staff and also the players around me. There's some very good players that you can learn from, some very good leaders. So today was just basically trying to apply the things that we learned in the training camp in Dubai earlier this week, and trying to execute as good as we can. It's so crazy. Growing up together as kids, and finally achieving something that's so big, especially for not only for Australian kids, also our community. It shows them that nothing is impossible. You know, you work hard and you dedicate yourself. then your opportunity will be given.
That's Thomas Dang. Well, Mark Milligan gave a moving tribute to the new Socceroos debutants.
I was going to talk about my debut and where it all began, but I don't think that's appropriate tonight. I think everybody in this room knows how hard the journey to get here is. Maybe not everyone knows how hard it was, especially for these two players. And I think it would... I don't want to talk about it too much because I don't feel it's I could do it justice. What I will say is congratulations on making it here. And what I do know is that the hard work to stay here, it begins now. It's a great group to be involved in. I've been around for quite a while now. And I can honestly say this is probably the most enjoyment that I've had with this team, with this group of players. So I want to congratulate you on making your debut tonight and a goal as well. So I'll ask Danny and Ayua to come up and we have a couple jerseys for you to hold on to.
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to say thank you to all the players, all the coaches, and thank you for making us feel, normal and making us feel part of the group. Because, as Millsy said, we've had some tough background, but, we'll not change that for anything because it just makes us stronger. And thank you guys for making it easier to be part of this group.
Yeah, I like to thank the boys and the staff as well. It's my first camp. You made it very welcoming for me to come into the group. And you made it so easy for me to come in and get on with things. And just appreciate all you guys.
Well, it was an incredible milestone for two childhood friends who grew up in Adelaide, bonding over the love of football and were fortunate enough to debut for the Socceroos.
Absolutely fantastic story. I was really impressed with Mark Milligan's leadership skills and the way he's incorporated those guys into the group. It's so clear that they've got a pretty strong bond already. And it's just fantastic to see, just given the current climate. I mean, there's been a fair bit of abuse and vitriol directed at the South Sudanese community, particularly here in Melbourne, which we don't need to go too far into. But it is very powerful to see these two young South Sudanese boys who came over as refugees just playing for the national team, being as proud Australians and being so proud and owning their upbringing and their background. And it's what football is all about for me, and it's what this country is all about, because our national team has always been one of the most diverse, going around people from all different backgrounds, united by a love of football and united by whether it's their adopted home, whether they've had their family here for generations upon generations. It doesn't matter. And that's what it's all about. And I think these two guys are fantastic role models for their community and, for all young Socceroos fans. I think they can go a long way in this national setup.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've said there. And do you think that it's reflective of, Mark Milligan at the moment with his leadership skills and maybe him potentially moving in to solidify the captaincy role?
It's interesting. There are quite a few candidates. I think Trent Sainsbury's still a really strong one. Perhaps, maybe not yet. Maybe he has to wait until Millsy calls it a day. But also Matt Leckie and Matty Ryan would all be prospective candidates, I would imagine. But Mark Milligan, he's just been involved in the national team for so long. I mean, what, 2005, 2006 was when he was first called up under Kiddick. And it's just been a consistent national team appearances since then. So he's just a stalwart. He's seen so many coaches come and go. He's seen so many players come and go, and he's got so much valuable experience to impart. And I think he made a telling comment there that, it's one of the, he's probably the national team camp that he's enjoyed the most. So, what Phil Moss was saying about Graham Arnold getting everybody to enjoy themselves and bond as people is obviously true. And, if Millsy says it, I believe him, because he's experienced so much as a player at so many different clubs, and more importantly, with so many different iterations of the national team. So I think he's a very good choice for captain if that's the way it goes.
And on that note, after the game, we did hear from the Socceroos head coach, Graham Arnold, who spoke about the captaincy.
Yeah, well, look, Mark Milligan for me has always been a leader. I had him in the Olympic team. He was my captain in 2008 with the Olympic team. He's captain of Melbourne Victory, and he knows what's required as a captain. And I will try another two in November, and I know how important the decision is of being captain of your country, and it's obviously a huge honour, but it takes responsibility as well, and I'll make my decision at the end of that.
And Graham Arnold also spoke more generally on the performance.
Yeah, look, for our first game, quite satisfied. Obviously, we've got a lot to improve on, and all I can judge them on is what we've done at training, and we've worked extremely hard on our principles of, you know, build up with rotations and penetrating runs, and worked hard on the pressing. And if I judge the boys on that, I couldn't be proud of them. Yeah, look, very, very important, Daniel, because, you know, I've changed the system and I've changed the way we're playing. And, you know, when it works, it builds belief. And the boys believe, and after that result, they'll believe in what we're doing. And, you know, obviously it's never easy to come here to Q8 and to put a dominating performance in like that. And, you know, with that type of performance, as I said, it builds belief. But the boys can see what we're doing is right. And you can see on their faces they're enjoying it.
That's the Socceroos head coach, Graham Arnold. And it's really interesting because obviously it's a new era. We move into a new World Cup cycle, and we're seeing the start of something that he is going to build towards. And I guess the first project is the Asian Cup. We only have two more games left in preparation for that, Lebanon and Korea. Do you think that that's enough time, Josh?
I think it's a very short turnaround, but as Phil Moss said, and as people will point out, Graham Arnold knows these players better than a foreign coach would coming in. It was a very challenging time for Bert van Marwijk to get to grips with the Australian team, even though he'd coached against them. That's not the same as being involved in Australian football circles for years and years and years and coaching against players in the A-League and watching national team games just because you're a fan of the national team. I think it's also key that a local coach has a long-term outlook, because Van Marwijk is not necessarily going to bring through young players for the sake of the next 5 to 10 years. But Graham Arnold will, because he's in this for the long haul and he's invested in the future of Australian football in the way that, you know, a short-term foreign appointment wouldn't be. So I think the short turnaround is easier for someone like Graham Arnold, but even then, to change the playing style so rapidly and so radically from Ange to Bert van Marwijk to Arnie, when you're going with three very different outlooks on the game, it puts the players in a difficult position.
Well, yes and no, but Graham Arnold was saying that obviously the boys are really happy, and you can see that by some of the footage that we've seen of them training. Obviously with Bert van Marwijk, he adopted a Diego Simeone-like defence and
a deep block, wasn't
and
it?
Style of play where, yes, he defended quite strongly, and you know, we saw how that played out against some of our opponents at the FIFA World Cup in Russia, and how beneficial it was to some extent. And then we had Ange Postecoglou, who was a lot more attacking, and then had a little bit maybe too many gaps in defence.
Yeah, arguably.
A bit of a leaky defence.
I mean, back in 2015, the Socceroos had a pretty good defence. They were really lacking in a right-back, and that's one of the reasons he chose to change to a back three and try and incorporate, you know, all those fantastic central midfield and attacking midfield players that the Socceroos have at their disposal. It didn't quite work. It seemed to be still a work in progress when he stepped down, and I was disappointed because I loved watching Ange coach the national team because he was so ambitious, because he took risks, and so few coaches do. Arnie seems to be maybe a happy medium in between. He's not a possession-focused coach, so like Ange is, so he's not going to, you know, play his way out of his own defensive corner. He's going to be a bit more pragmatic than that. But also, he does want to get players in the box. He does want to score goals. And that's one of the things he was talking about in the lead-up to the game, is that you need three, four attacking players getting on the end of those deliveries to really have a good chance of scoring goals. And that's not what we saw under Van Marwijk. The attacking players, in particular Andrew Nabut playing up front, were very isolated. So having that intent while having a solid defensive base and those two holding midfield players to build upon, it could be very successful, I think. It's just a question of whether this team can adapt in time to be able to defend their Asian Cup crown.
Do you think that they will?
Oh, it's tough to say. There's quality all around Asia. I mean, the Japanese team was very strong at the World Cup, surprisingly so. Even the Japanese media were quite surprised by how well they did. And South Korea, of course, always a huge threat. And then the Iranian national team did fantastically well at the World Cup as well. I think they're real contenders who were unlucky not to get further last time out. So there's some solid competition from all across Asia. I don't think it's a given by any means, but I think Australia has to be up there with the favourites.
And certainly a smile on some of the boys' faces is, you know,
never
hurts. Quarter of the way there.
It never hurts. I mean, you know, you don't have to be friends. It's a professional environment, but I don't think it hurts at all. And when you've got so many players with close club relationships or past relationships, it helps build those ties on the field. And you've got, you know, Jamie McLaren and Martin Boyle coming in from Hibs alongside Mark Milligan. You've got obviously Mabil and Deng and
Rogic and Arzani.
Exactly. So I think that's a huge boost. And when the players that don't have those club links, most of them have been playing together for quite a while. I mean, Matt Ryan and Trent Sainsbury actually do, you know, back in Central Coast Mariners days as well. So you see those little relationships all across the field, and it helps the team become a more cohesive unit more quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And I was getting at the point where Graham Arnold is saying he really actually wants his team to play free-flowing football, and he wants to give them the freedom to, you know, basically not do whatever they want, but, you know, give them some freedom and you know, show what they're capable of, whereas some coaches in the past have been a little bit more structured, kept them on the leash.
I would say so. The thing I would quibble with that is the two midfield players. It was Luongo and Irvine this morning. I wonder how Aaron Moy is going to fit into things, because he's been such a key figure for the past few years in terms of being that midfielder who can distribute so well. But he's a limited player defensively. He doesn't cover much ground. And he is someone who leaves gaps at the back despite all of his great qualities. So I wonder how Graham Arnold is going to incorporate him. Is he going to trust him as one of those screening midfielders, or is he going to have to play him further up the park, or is he going to make it onto the pitch as a first-choice player? I think he probably has to, given he's playing in the Premier League, but that's sort of at odds with Graham Arnold's style.
And how do you think that affects Mark Milligan's position as well?
I think Milligan will probably stick in the back line. I don't think you're going to see him playing in the midfield at this point, although coaches love him because he can cover so many positions. I think he will stay as a central defender. The question is whether, Aaron Moy has to be moved further up the park, and then that affects Rogic's position. I don't think we're going to see him move away from a 4-2-3-1 very often, because that's his formula that he's perfected at Central Coast and at Sydney. So whether that you see Aaron Moy and Rogic alternating in a number 10 role, whether you do see Moy playing as one of the two screeners and having to maybe take on extra defensive responsibilities like he has done to an extent at Huddersfield, a struggling Premier League outfit, it's going to be really interesting to see.
Well, Josh, we are going to take a quick break, and there'll be plenty more Socceroos chat after this.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR. You're with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And Josh, I believe we've got a Twitter poll up at the moment.
We do indeed. The question is, has the great performance by the Socceroos this morning made you more optimistic about Graham Arnold's reign? There was a lot of negativity when he was announced. I think it's partially connected to maybe his media personality and his time in charge of Sydney FC, because, you know, A-League fans, if they're not Sydney FC fans, they do usually are not that big fans of them, and because they were so successful, everyone, you know, sort of resented them. So I think it's connected mostly to that, and maybe not so much to his style as a coach, but other people, you know, might argue that he's got a defensive reputation and he's not a step, you know, forward. But this morning gave me a lot of cause for optimism, and I'm wondering whether the FNR fans out there feel the same way.
Well, speaking of resentment, Robbie Cruse has really emerged as a Socceroos leader just months after some vicious attacks from some online trolls, and you feel really strongly about this.
Yeah, he's really been, I guess, a hate figure and a whipping boy for the online brigade, and he really copped not just footballing criticism during the World Cup, but some of the stuff I saw online was very deeply personal. People, you know, messaging his family and so forth. And
his family?
Yeah, it went way overboard. And I suppose the anonymity of social media makes people think these things are okay. But, you know, the players read this stuff. You know, they're not immune. They've got their Twitter mentions on. They're gonna hear about it when it's in the media. And he's come out pretty strongly saying that, you know, he's not concerned about it. He said social media gives really unimportant people a chance to voice their opinions. It's really not important for me. I listen to the people who I need to, my family, my coaches, and most importantly, my teammates. If they're disappointed in me, then I'd be more affected, but they're really happy with the way I do things. I do a lot of stuff that people don't notice on the football pitch. My teammates really value that in my game. And I think that's an admirable attitude from him. I think that's what he has to take. He has to ignore it and just listen to his coaches and the people close to him and not to the online social media trolls. And that last point, he does do a lot of stuff that isn't noticed. He runs the most out of anybody on the field, both in terms of kilometres covered and the amount of sprints he does during the game. He works tremendously hard. He's just got such incredible work rate. And his movement off the field...
Well,
is,
that's it.
Is really, like, his movement off the pitch, you know, is just, you know, unbelievable. When you don't look at the player in possession all the time and you look at it, say, where the options are coming from, he's the one who's making all sorts of runs between the lines, creating options for passes, moving players around and acting as a decoy. And you'll notice that the team, generally speaking, generates more chances when he's on the field, even if his end product at sometimes is frustrating.
Well, and he has been around for quite some time, and it's only Mark Milligan that's had more caps than him.
Yeah, you don't get, 60-odd, 70-odd Socceroos caps without being a player that coaches love. And he's just a valuable player because, you know, people are arguing for Arzani to start, and I can understand that because he is a spectacular player and can do a lot with the ball. But can he last 90 minutes? I don't think he can.
Well, he had a lively cameo last night.
Oh, yeah, he was
fantastic. Plenty of chances, put two shots wide.
And when he comes on for the last half hour, 15 minutes, he can make things happen against a tired defence. But it's Robbie Cruz who's done the legwork, tiring out his fullback so that Arzani can come on and be a game breaker. And I think at this point in Arzani's career, when he isn't getting that much first-team football under his belt, when he's not making it through 90 minutes most of the time, I think the super sub role is more suitable for him.
And there's nothing wrong with that at all. You know, a question that came up last night was whether or not Arzani should go to the Asian Cup if he is not getting first-team game time at Celtic. What do you think?
It's tough because I think I would probably take him anyway. I think it's a little bit out of his hands as to whether he's getting game time at Celtic because, you know, Brendan Rodgers has decided that he's not up to the physical side of things. And no matter how many free kicks he puts into the top corner in the reserves and what have you, he's probably not going to get a look in. It doesn't seem that, you know, Rodgers really rates him. And I don't know why they picked him up if he's on loan, if he's not going to get first-team football. But that's the reality in Europe. I would take him anyway because he's a special player.
I agree with you there. And he has the X factor, as we've seen. He has the ability to change a game. And I certainly think you need to include him in the Asian Cup squad, regardless if he's getting first-team game time or not, because he is getting game time with the reserves.
Yeah, and even if he goes back to Manchester City in December and he's playing
in training.
He
definitely won't get game time there.
Of course not, but he'd be playing in training with top-class players. Even the Manchester City reserves and their youth team are really world-class. So I think he's just too good a player to leave out.
Well, continuing the Socceroos flavour, and in the context of Thomas Deng and Awa Mabil debuting for the Socceroos, we have Asma Hilal from Football United who joins us now to discuss her work with refugees and football. Asma, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Firstly, tell us a little bit about some of the organisations you work for.
So my main role at this in the paid capacity is as the operations program manager for Creating Chances and Football United. So it's a not-for-profit organization that uses sport as a tool to promote positive outcomes for young people at a personal level and at a societal level. So sport or football is a tool of engagement, but youth development is the outcome. So that's, yeah, my main daily job, but I also sit on an advisory committee called Go Active, or For Go Active, which is an initiative of the Lebanese Muslim Association, where we deliver and design programs that encourage sports participation for Muslim women, but also culturally and linguistically diverse women, and a whole range of other things. But yeah, those are my main hacks, you could say.
You sound pretty busy, Asma. It's Josh here, by the way. And
Hey, tell us
a little bit about Football United. I understand there's a bit of academic research that's gone into the program about including people and helping refugees assimilate to Australian culture.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're quite a unique program and an organisation that is based out of the University of New South Wales with the School of Public Health, and it was founded in 2006. So we create chances for young people from disadvantaged communities. When you look at football, you know, it's got this unique power to attract and inspire particularly young people. And by its very nature, it's about inclusion. And it stands for values such as respect, acceptance, teamwork and fairness. So we use that as a way to address some of the issues young people are facing as they settle into a new environment and overcome some of the challenges that they face, which typically involves, language barriers, understanding the education system, especially with disrupted schooling, especially for refugee young people, finding employment, so families, settling into a new environment, trying to learn a new language, and then finding employment to survive is a big barrier. And then there's feelings of isolation. So over the years, we've been in existence for over 11 years now. So we've had some research that underpins the work that we do. And some of the benefits include things like increased resilience, especially for girls, and improved pro-social behaviour. So that means, including young people encouraging young people to volunteer and lead programs in their schools and in their communities. And then other outcomes in reduced peer problems and reduced problems in racial bullying and promoting cross-cultural relationships. So really trying to promote inclusion within the environments that they're settling into. So it's not just a refugee program. We're engaging young people of all backgrounds. And then ultimately that results in a positive mindset, promoting positive health and well-being for the young person and their families.
It sounds absolutely fantastic, Asma. In your experience, on the front lines, can involvement in these football programs really be life-changing for these young people?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I've been involved since 2009, and I've been very fortunate to see the progress of young people coming in as participants and then coming out over the years who are now award-winning humanitarians, traveling the world, speaking at the UN and sharing their stories and completing university degrees, you name it. And when you look at our program, I guess, or when you look at football as a whole, if you see sitting on a continuum, for example, on one side, you look at Football Plus, which is really about football developing the athlete, the coaches, the football industry, right? Where you look at the secondary benefits in health and fitness. And then on the other end, if you call it Plus Football, which is really about using football to achieve non-sporting outcomes. So looking at achieving positive social change, education outcomes, mentoring, reducing or preventing violence. So where Football United sits is really in between all of that, where we look at providing coach education and quality football sessions for young people to make it more accessible, because football currently for young people who arrive within the first 2 years can be quite challenging logistically. So we provide free accessible programs that are high quality, of high standard, with role model coaches. But at the same time, we deliver evidence-based life skills and leadership education to help young people prepare for life beyond the football field and ultimately be better human beings for society.
And speaking of role models, it's really touching to hear about the story of Thomas Deng and Awa Mabil to have come from the background that they've come from and gone on to make their Socceroos debuts. Have they inspired some of the players you might work with?
Look, I have to say it is extremely exciting and heartening to see Awer and Thomas do their thing. You know, although Football United isn't so focused on developing young people into elite athletes, it's, as I said, extremely heartening. You know, many of our talented young people we work with who want to pursue football as a career generally are often disheartened because they see and experience the club politics that are involved, right? And while this still might exist, it just shows that people like Awer and Thomas have had their chance to shine with the Socceroos. And hearing about their journey is a common story for thousands of young people that we work with. So they are beacons of hope. And it allows young people to be more hopeful towards their playing career if that's something they want to pursue. But also, you know, society in general, as the diversity in the squad reflects who we are as a nation, ultimately.
And just in regards to, I mean, you've mentioned a little bit about some of the racial bullying that you encounter and, you know, it's the climate at the moment. I don't know if I'm making a gross generalisation when I say that there seems to be, maybe heightened racial tensions in this country currently with some of the stuff that's going on in the media, especially here in Melbourne with the African gang storyline plastered across many tabloid newspapers. Has that made it, a noticeable impact on the young people that you work with?
I mean, it's very a recent story. But, I mean, if we look at multiculturalism in Australia, multiculturalism generally can enrich football. And there's so much hidden talent pools across the country that can be tapped into and can be neglected, hence why I commend Arnold's vision and belief in Awer and Thomas. But if we look at multiculturalism, that's what brought football to what it is today, you know. It's such a powerful tool. Almost half of Australians were born overseas or have a parent who was. And this is a true representation of where we should be, I believe.
Well, Asma, we really thank you for coming on the program tonight and commend you for the work you do through football. It's really heartening to hear how much of a difference it can make in these young people's lives.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on. Thanks for having me.
That was Asma Hilal from Football United and Creating Chances. It's really inspiring stuff, and I'm sure that the young people that she works with will be looking up to the likes of Thomas and Awa after their performances this morning.
I'm sure they will, and that fact that I brought you just before the break was that there are over 400 football teams in their community overseas. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it's insane, and the football just spans the globe. You know, you can hear these statistics all day long, and they never stop being shocked and surprised and heartened by how much of a global game it really is. And, you know, I think it's also a great opportunity with these communities, the football mad communities and new arrivals coming to Australia to try and bring them through, you know, both as elite athletes, but also just further down the train in terms of community football. I think it really could enrich the football culture in this country, just as so many of the post-World War II European migrants really enriched the game in Australia, but by creating so many clubs and really building the football culture for the future. The next wave of, refugees and especially African migrants could further enrich that and really help the Socceroos, as the two boys have done this morning, but also develop the game further in this country.
Well, that's it. And what Asma was touching on was, the work she does, with football is to achieve non-sporting outcomes like social change and preventing violence and, giving them a place to feel like they belong.
Yeah. And, that's what Awer and Thomas said this when Milligan presented them with their jerseys. You know, thanks for making us feel like part of the group, because, that's so important. And I think sporting teams are critical in terms of helping people feel like they belong and not feeling so isolated. So really commend Asma for all the work that she does and really commend the Socceroos camp for all the work that they've done with these guys.
Well, Josh, we are going to take a quick break, but coming up is some more A-League talk, and also we'll touch on some of our youth national teams. This is Evenings on FNR.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
This is Evenings on FNR. You're with Louise Taffer and Josh Parrish. And before we get to some of the A-League talk, the young Socceroos played their last and final friendly against Singapore under-21s before they begin their AFC under-19 championship campaign, which commences this Friday. They open against Korea Republic, followed by Vietnam and Jordan. And elsewhere, the young Matildas head coach Gary Van Egmond has named a 23-player squad to travel to Lebanon later this month for the first phase of qualifying for the 2019 AFC Under-19 Women's Championship. They're in Group A against host Lebanon, as well as Hong Kong and Mongolia. So great to see that there's plenty going on in and amongst our youth national teams.
And it's great to see that at least one person at the station can keep up with all the competitions that our youth national teams are playing in and the correct names for them as well. I find it endlessly disorienting, all of the acronyms and so forth. But, you know, look, I had a look through the Young Matildas squad or the that Gary Van Egmond named, and there's some serious talent in there. And I think I'm really excited about Princess Abini, who just made her debut for the Matildas. Chloe Legazzo mentioned her when we chatted to her earlier in the program, and she's, I think, the sister of Bernie Abini.
She is indeed.
People may remember him, a former Sydney FC player, of course, now playing over in the UAE, and she's got some X factor about her.
She does indeed, and she is headlining the squad, as is Amy Sayer and also Rachel Lowe, who have all featured at senior level already. While there's quite a lot of young players coming into the squad who, you know, are well-known and making their names well-known in the W League, we saw Melbourne City's Sophia Sakalis and her best friend, which is Kyra Cooney-Cross, and she's at her cross-city rival at Melbourne Victory. So both of them have been included in the squad, as has Canberra United's young gun Carly Rosbach and even Perth Glory's young Jacinta. So it'll be a great team to take on some of the best countries in Asia.
Fantastic. Shall we talk A-League, Louise?
Yes, we will get there. Of course, the campaign begins on Friday.
It's Sydney FC taking on Adelaide United at Hindmarsh. We're going to have a full preview of that game coming up on Friday's show. And plus, we're going to jump on air after the final whistle for our match of the round coverage. So if you've got thoughts on the game, you've been watching it, then give us a call on 9944 9999, and we'll feel free to take your post-match rants. If you've been displeased with a coaching or refereeing decision, or you just want to rub it into the opposition, make sure you give us a call after the game.
Well, I was actually at Melbourne City this morning, and things are looking quite good from their perspective. Not many injuries at all. And the only thing is, though, that they do have quite a number of players out on Young Socceroos duty. Nathaniel Atkinson, Rami Nazarin. They have James Delianov, the goalkeeper, Dylan Pariah. So quite a lot of them, the young kids, are away. But one of the more senior and experienced players, Richie Delatt, spoke about pre-season and his relationship with his old coach, Warren Joyce.
From when I've been here, there has been. Like I said, at the training ground, and that, you know, everyone's excited. Everyone, you know, really thinks we have a good chance of being up there this season, and we're going to take it one game at a time. But, you know, we're quietly confident that, you know, if we take it one game at a time, we can really achieve something this year.
Richie, how have you adjusted? I mean, in England, you'd be 2 months into the season by now. it's the world's longest off season. Has it been difficult mentally for you to cope with this endless build up?
No, it's been good for me. It's been, you know, two pre-seasons really. I didn't really get my chance anyway in the UK to go and play football, so I was only training there. So I came here and got another pre-season into me, which really helped getting fit. Got a couple of friendlies in, and like I said, I'm excited now that the season's close by and we can get going on Saturday.
You worked with Warren Joyce when you were a young fellow at Manchester United. Have you seen much change in Warren as a coach in the way he operates?
No.
The way he relates to players?
No.
No?
No, he's still exactly the same. I've had him at when I was 17 at Antwerp. I've had him when I was 19 at United, and I've got him now when I'm 29 at Melbourne, and he hasn't changed one bit. So he still does the same training sessions. He's still as honest as he has been to every player out there. And the only thing he wants from you is that you put 110% in every day on the training pitch, and obviously on the match day as well. And then, you know, everyone make mistakes. You're a footballer, everyone's going to make mistakes. But as long as you work hard, that's all he asks of you.
That's Melbourne City's latest defender, Richie Delatt. And can he nullify Victory's star power this weekend?
He's going to have a task ahead of him. I mean, I do wonder whether Victory are going to start the season with any sort of a bang, because their preseason results have been very, very unimpressive.
They have. How much do you read into that?
I mean,
a loss against Adelaide United and Wellington Phoenix.
There's been a lot of changes in the Victory squad, a lot of key players leaving and a lot of new exciting recruits coming in. And the likes of Honda and Toivonen are going to take some time to bed in, I think, but I do think Melbourne Victory are going to start the season slowly, and people are going to panic, and suddenly Kevin Muscat's going to be under pressure, and then they'll kick into gear, you know, when coming into Christmas, and we'll all look like fools for having overreacted. That's the pattern of things often at the Victory. They usually do start slow, especially under Muscat, but get to the business end and they're, you know, in with a shot. So I doubt they're going to finish top of the table. I really don't think they're even really, really in with a sniff of it, but they'll be in the finals mix. And you know, once it gets to the finals, I think they're really a huge chance.
Well, that's it. And going off last season's results, the highest they actually got by the 10th round was only 7th. 6th once in the 9th round. Mm. But that is not good. They were even 9th. So it's always a slow start for Melbourne Victory. But then, as you say, they seem to come good after the 10th round and suddenly they creep up the ladder.
Yeah, and they've got too much quality in this squad to finish any lower than, you know, 5th or 6th. I mean, it's be absolutely
even
unthinkable.
Even lower than 3rd.
Yeah, I think they'll be definitely in the top 4 come the end of the season. But, you know, I'd be backing Melbourne City in the derby this weekend just because I think they're in better form coming into the game.
Do you have a score prediction?
Oh, I think there's always goals in the Melbourne derby. I think it'll be 2-1 to City.
Okay, well, there you go. I'm also interested to hear some of your other predictions in terms of the Golden Boot.
Oh, Golden Boot. I have to go with Sydney FC's Adam Lafondra, who has been hugely impressive. He's a natural goal scorer, and Sydney FC just have such good service. I mean, when you've got Milos Ninkovic supplying chances to you, it's going to make it pretty easy for him to bag goals. And Bobo was the top scorer last season. I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, playing in that Sydney FC setup gives you plenty of chances to score. So I'm going Adam Lafondra.
And Ninkovic is a dream to watch, just touching on him.
Oh, he's probably the best player in the A-League there has been over the past few seasons, I think almost undoubtedly. He's so consistent. He helps the team advance up the field. He's a very intelligent player with his positioning. And his passing and his technique on the ball is just, you know, you can't really have anyone in the league that matches him. So he's, Amir Zajewski was more spectacular last season because he scored so many more goals, and he's just, you know, those moments, those free kicks, those long range finishes were out of this world. But Ninkovic, in terms of the way the team actually functions, I would argue he's a more important player.
Now, a final word on some of the other end of season awards. Who are you predicting to take out the goalkeeper of the year at the other end of the pitch?
I think that's a tough one. Jamie Young, I think, is with a good shout to defend his crown. But I'm going to go for Mark Birigidi from Melbourne City, who has had some European experience coming back to the A-League. He was very solid last time he was here, and he's playing in front of a good defence. So I think he'll keep plenty of clean sheets and make plenty of good saves as well. And to be honest, I think he's a big upgrade on Dean Bouzanis.
The Johnny Warren medalist.
See, this is a really, really tough one. There's been so many high-profile imports coming into the league, as well as returning Socceroos. I mean, I think Craig Goodwin's in with a decent shout. But I'm going to go with an old favourite in Diego Castro, who is going to be whipped into shape by Tony Popovic. He usually has a 3-week preseason and he comes in half fit, because we know Diego Castro, for all his quality, doesn't really like training. But Tony Popovic is not going to let that stand. and he's going to get him in really good shape from the start of the season. I think they're going to have a really solid defensive basis to build on, and Castro is just going to be able to create chances and work his magic. Even at 35, I think he can repeat his trick from a couple of seasons ago and be player of the season.
Yeah, and I love how Diego Castro carries the ball. He is just so clever, weaving in and out of defenders and therefore, you know, converting his shots and chances.
Yeah. He's next level. He's really, I mean, it's only his age that makes him appropriate for this level. Like, he's out of this world. He's played in La Liga. I mean, he's such a fantastic player to watch and add so much to the league. And I think for all of Perth's off-season acquisitions, getting him to extend his contract is probably the biggest signing of them all.
What about the wooden spoon?
I'm going to... Oh, it's tough. It's really tough. I would have picked Central Coast Mariners, but they've picked up Ross McCormack, and I think he'll be enough to lift them off the bottom. Sadly, even though I'm a huge defender of the Knicks, and I think it will be Wellington Phoenix finishing bottom of the table. And it's going to be tough, but I just think too many teams have improved around them. I will say, though, there was a huge gap to the bottom of the table last season, and that's not going to exist this season. I think teams are going to be closer together.
And finally, the champions.
Well, I struggle to go past Sydney FC. I mean, I think people are writing them off because of the change in coaching and the change in players, but they've recruited absolutely brilliantly. The loss of Trent Bahadur really hurts, but, you know, I really can't look past them, given how dominant they were up until the finals last season. And, you know, you play that game against Melbourne Victory 10 times. I think Sydney wins 7 or 8 times out of 10 on home soil. So I think it's hard to go past Sydney for the championship. But, you know, giving them a good run for their money in the final series at least should be Melbourne Victory. And I think Perth Glory will be up there as well.
Well, there you go, Josh. Thank you for your predictions. And thank you for joining me this evening on Evenings on FNR. It's great to always have your company. We will leave it there, though. And remember, you can catch up on all of the interviews from tonight's show by heading to FNR's SoundCloud. This has been Louise Taffer, your host, and Josh Parrish with me in the studio. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.